How many ever heard of John Gano?
Yes, I did.
One, two, three, four, five. One of the greatest tragedies and horrible sins in our generation is that Baptists know nothing about their forefathers. Sometimes people say, why did the Baptists not write more theological treatises and books? The Presbyterians tease us. And we reply and say, that's because your forefathers had them chased in the caves trying to kill them. The life and ministry of John Gano.
John, he baptized George Washington in the Potomac.
Is that right? That's I didn't know that. All right. Please look at the table out there. Gary Long has, some years ago, felt a burden to reprint some of the great Baptist forefathers that we have, not just commentaries, but other things. Take a look at that. Robert Haldane has written probably the best commentary on Romans in print, and his brother James has written on Galatians and Hebrews. When only five people in a conference like this know somebody who had the effect upon our society and our Baptist history as much as John Gano did, then something is radically wrong. So look at that book table. Our speaker is Dr. Gary Long. I've known him for a long time, and he has been a good friend and a good brother, and we've appreciated our fellowship together. If you want to know what kind of a guy he is, he's a little bit like Tom Wells. He gets along with everybody. He's so nice. People ask us why we don't sit down with the people who disagree with us and discuss the differences. And of course, we have been trying to do this for years. When the law grace controversy first began in the 80s, the early 80s, and there was difficulties, Dr. Long, his church wrote to myself and two other people who took this side and three of the noted Reformed Baptists on the other side, and they said they would pay our way. It wouldn't be a public meeting, but we would get together for a couple of days in a room and discuss our differences and see if we could learn from each other. And Mr. McKinney and Tom Smith and myself wrote back and said, we'll pay our own way. You name the place, the time, and we'll be there. Unfortunately, the other side said, we don't want to talk about it because there's nothing to say, there's nothing to discuss. Well, that's the kind of a guy he is. He tries to get people together and tries to bring unity into the body of Christ, for which we greatly appreciate his efforts and yours too.
Well, good evening, and my name is Gary Long. One small correction, I'm not Dr. Gary Long. There is a Dr. Gary Long, and he may have been here, but John's very kind to call me Dr. Long. It's Dr. Gary D. Long, who lives now in Texas and has written the book Definite Atonement. I tell people that he's the doctor and I'm the nurse. We're good friends. But if you knew how little Bible education, formal Bible education I had, and I didn't tell this to Brother Fred before, but you wouldn't have me here if you knew. That's why I speak on people that have had very little formal education in the area of religious things. But Dr. Gary Long did tell me that, and I asked him, I said, I get people coming up to me all the time saying, did you write the book or would you autograph the Definite Atonement or some of the other books you wrote? And I've talked to the other Gary Long, and he said, listen, brother, he said, you sign them. You're as much Gary Long as I am. So. We started Particular Baptist Press in 1995, and we have 15 books in print. Our books are out there, and I really appreciate Brother John's kind words about the press, trying to make these known. Folks, it's a ministry, and you'll think ministry when you see our prices compared to the other good price books out there. Our books are higher priced, but we are very small. We print small quantities. We do a very high quality binding, and they are expensive books, but we guarantee you that they're worth every penny that you spend. We live and die on standing orders, and I'm just going to make that plug. If you're interested in Baptist history and what we do, we have standing orders. We've got 115 standing orders with colleges, universities, and seminaries around the country. They'll take any book we print because they know the kind of quality. Nobody's doing what we're doing. We have about 30 to 40 individuals who support us. And some, I've got a man in Memphis, Tennessee, who says, I don't read the books. He says, I don't even take them out of the wrappers. He says, I just want to support you. He says, I put them up there on the shelf. Well, that's not, you know, that's nice, but we would like them read. But then we have about 10 standing orders with churches. And so we have one full-time employee, Terry Wolliver, who wrote the book on John Gano, or Gano, however you like. But you feel free to browse and look at the books. While I'm with you, I'm going to be bringing three biographical sketches. And I don't mind telling you that these are three of my heroes. I've got a lot of heroes, and I hope you do too. Heroes are good, and they're biblical. According to Hebrews chapter 13, we should have heroes, and chapter 11 is all about our heroes. I'm going to bring you a sketch on Isaac McCoy this evening, Lord willing, and then my next session will be on a man by the name of William Nibb, who I want you to know these people and appreciate them for what they did for the cause of Christ. And then I am going to attempt to do one on C.H. Spurgeon. I know all of you have C.H. Spurgeon biographies and you've read them, and you'll know as much about Spurgeon as I do, and some of you a lot more. But I have tried to dig out some things about Spurgeon that you may not know from writings of others. And I'm on the board for the Spurgeon Library. Some of you may not know that C.H. Spurgeon's personal library is at William Jewell College in Liberty, Missouri. We have the C.H. Spurgeon Conference every other year, and we're having it this year, the last of May, and there's some brochures out there if you're interested in that conference. But the reason we have it at William Jewell is they open up Mr. Spurgeon's library to us, and we go through and we try to still find those nuggets and those hidden things that others don't know about, and sure enough, we'll open up a book that was given maybe to Mr. Spurgeon by the great Presbyterian Hodge on theology, and here's a letter in there, a personal letter from Mr. Hodge to C.H. Spurgeon saying, we hope that you benefit and appreciate this work, because many of you know that in Spurgeon's commenting and commentaries that he wrote, he could kill a book or he could sell it, and if he would endorse it, it'd sell. So a lot of these people wrote and says, sure hope you enjoy my book. It's free. But at any rate, we will try to deal with Spurgeon on that. And by the way, also at William Jewell College is the John Gano Memorial Chapel.
Amen.
Gano was never in Missouri. He's buried in Frankfort, Kentucky, in a grave that has just been had a beautiful granite stone placed over the grave of John and Sarah Gano, or Gano, however, we have family contact. Some pronounce it Gano, some pronounce it Gano, some even say Gano. But at any rate, pastor of the First Baptist Church of New York and was a chaplain in the Revolutionary Army, is reported to have baptized George Washington in either the Hudson or the Potomac River. We've got Volume 1 done. We'll have all that story in Volumes 2 and 3, but at any rate, I want to talk to you this evening and bring you a paper presented, and I hope that you'll appreciate the life of this man and his wife more when we're through. It's on Isaac McCoy. Now, our little press wants to be known as the Isaac McCoy people. We have four books that we've only got 15 books in print. Four of them are on Isaac McCoy. And we also carry a book out there. I've only brought one of each, hardback and a paperback, of a book called Isaac McCoy and the American Indians by Carol Lehman. It's a biographical novel, a wonderful book. She's right on the money, and it's not written from a religious perspective, but this man was, I hope you'll see, was a great, great Christian. The years of his existence are, and by the way, I'm supposed to be through by what time, Brother Fred? Or Brother John?
I don't know.
I'll be through, well, okay, I'll be through by then. His years are from 1784 to 1846. For those of you who are Pennsylvanians, I hope you'll appreciate it. This man was born in Pennsylvania. And Austin Lyons said, Isaac McCoy is one of that large group of men of unusual ability about whom the world knows too little. Other home missionaries of the Baptist denomination who have accomplished less than McCoy are now more widely known and appreciated. A man who can conceive so many plans for advancing the Christian cause and who can execute his plans over almost impossible obstacles deserves more than a passing acquaintance. And he was right. We must understand some of what existed in those early colonial days regarding the Indian and the white man. Although the Pilgrims were welcomed by the Indians of Plymouth in 1620, the following century brought the two cultures into direct conflict. The Indians were uncivilized and, as others have suggested, had failed to grasp the simplest invention of a civilized people, the wheel. With such simplicity, they became easy prey for the ever-expanding hordes of white men. When it came to these children of the forest, there was little or no conscience, as the Indians were cheated, pushed, fought, and betrayed so much that by the time Isaac McCoy was born in 1784, we could summarize the early American Indians' introduction to civilization as one of exploitation for their gold by the explorers, for their pelts by the traders, and for their land by the settler. Then there were the missionaries, who by and large were genuinely concerned for the soul and well-being of the red man. These missionaries were the vanguards of civilization and hope, yet too often losing the battle to their own government as treaties are broken and white men allowed to drive the Indians from their own land. Then too, the weapon more devastating and powerful than the white man's musket or cannon was the introduction of whiskey. Drunkenness was to become the great and formidable enemy that met the missionaries wherever they went. To this degrading and unrelenting problem, the U.S. government was conveniently apathetic. Mr. Lyon has correctly noted, he says, quote, the relation of the government of the United States toward the Indians has been that of careless indifference. And he concludes, the government had no constructive policy for caring for the red man. But that's to do with the Indians of his time. But concerning Isaac McCoy, James McCoy is Isaac's grandfather. He came to this country from Northern Ireland as a teenage indentured orphan to Baltimore. After several years in Virginia, he moved back to Maryland and married Anne Bruce, who, by the way, you can trace that back to the famous Bruce family and a king. When the part of Pennsylvania known as Fayette County was opened to settlers in 1769, the McCoy family was among the first to locate there. This couple had six children, one of whom was William McCoy, who becomes a Baptist preacher and later pioneered along the Kentucky frontier. He is credited with founding Silver Creek Baptist Church across the Ohio River, which was the first Baptist church in the Indiana Territory. That's Isaac's father. William, like his father, also had six children, which included Isaac, born June 13, 1784, in Fayette County, Pennsylvania, near Uniontown. When Isaac was 5 years old, the family moved to Kentucky. They settled near the Ohio River, about 17 miles east of Louisville, which was itself at that time only a little town with its back against the wilderness. They later moved to Shelby County, Kentucky. In the same year that Thomas Jefferson is inaugurated as the new president, Isaac McCoy is converted to Christ, is baptized, and joins the Plum Creek Baptist Church. In his youth, being raised under Baptist influence and a godly mother, he says, "My morality and particularly my aversion to dancing induced my associates, by way of derision, to call me a Methodist, which I considered a reproachful epithet and a grand insult, and although I stood alone, I was determined to resent it even to blows." So, at the age of 19, he married 16-year-old Christiana Polk, who can also be traced to the Polks in the presidency, a lady of great fortitude and demeanor that had been overshadowed by her illustrious husband. Their granddaughter describes Christiana as a cheery, sympathetic wife who nobly shared his zeal and self-abnegation and deserves to share the credit and the honor of the tribute of respect and praise so generally bestowed by historians upon Mr. McCoy. The granddaughter's conclusion is quite right when she considered Christiana's background. Christiana was the first child born after her mother and siblings had been captured by the Ottawas on a raid in Nelson County, Kentucky. The mother and the three brothers and sisters were taken to the village around Detroit, walked, by the way, and she was in poor health, and kept in captivity for 13 months. The family were finally ransomed by the father, Captain Charles Polk, and returned to their home in Kentucky where Christiana was born. A lasting tribute paid to Christiana by her husband, Isaac, is recorded by granddaughter Nellie when McCoy was doing expedition work around Fort Wayne, Indiana. She says, "In roaming around this region, Mr. McCoy discovered a beautiful brook, cheery, clear, and placid. He said he at once thought of his dear wife, in whom these qualities were so pronounced, and upon learning the stream was unnamed, he gave it the name of his wife, Christiana." And Nellie says, "Today," and this was written in 1921, "today, more than a century later, not only is the brook still called by the name, but also the mills built upon it, a lake, and a clubhouse, and pleasure boats there also bear the name Christiana." Some of you from southern Michigan may know where Christiana Lake is and Christiana Stream. When first married, the McCoys settled near Vincennes in the Indiana Territory, and finding no Baptist of his doctrinal persuasion where he might minister, for McCoy was an unwavering Calvinist, and undoubtedly with no work at his trade as a wheelwright, he received an appointment as the town jailer, which at least provided housing. His father, the Baptist preacher, with undisguised sarcasm or good humor, he wrote, "While I expected you were proclaiming liberty to the captives, I hear that you are keeping the keys to the prison." Later, an opportunity to preach comes, and then follows an invitation to minister regularly to the small congregation at Mariah Creek, just 8 miles from Vincennes. In 1810, without formal education, he is ordained by this church. In a short time, McCoy, with some Kentucky Baptist support, begins probing the Indian Territory further west across Illinois and to what he called the Devil's Empire, a place known today as St. Louis. Still the Devil's Empire, I think. He would find the religious ferment of the West lacking in theological soundness, and he records in his journals, "Have not heard a Baptist sermon since last August." And again he says, They have heard little preaching, and I fear would be content with less." McCoy, mainline and deeply suspicious of Arminian liberalism, asked every Baptist he met his specific kind of dogma. The next year, in 1817, he offers himself to the Board of Foreign Missions for Missionary Services in St. Louis among the white population, with his work among the Indians to be secondary. However, he was assigned to his home state of Indiana with permission to work among the Indians. He was grateful for the one-year appointment and entered the work with great enthusiasm. This same year, he makes the commitment under a guiding providence and a selfless love for the souls of the Indians to employ the remainder of his life and labors in the promotion of the temporal and eternal welfare of the Indian. The next 2 years were to prove very difficult, for in August 1818, Mahala, the eldest of their 8 children, dies while Isaac is away on a missionary tour. Of this he says, "While absent from my family upon tour of some weeks among the churches of Kentucky, our eldest child, a daughter between 13 and 14 years of age, sickened and died of typhus fever. This stroke was the more severe on account of its occurring in my absence. Nevertheless, we afterward believed that the event was sanctified to our benefit in inducing us with less reluctance to go to the hold which our affections had upon people and things of the regions of civilized society, and enabling us to trust all, our children, ourselves, and our interests to God. At the time this child died, Christiana was 3 months expectant with their 9th child. 2 months later, Isaac, Christiana, and their children leave for their first mission on Raccoon Creek, just north of Terre Haute. He says it was on the 27th of October, 1818, that we set out for the mission premises, a distance from our former residence of 90 miles. My commission, he said, from the board had ere this expired. With my wife and seven small children, I went into the wilderness to seek an opportunity of preaching Christ to the Indians without a promise of patronage from anyone, looking to heaven for help and trusting that God would dispose the hearts of some, we knew not who, to give my family bread while I should give myself wholly to the service of the heathen. The Raccoon Creek mission was unsuccessful except for hiring a young frontiersman by the name of Corby Martin. He also became McCoy's first convert. Martin came to the mission claiming to be a deist, but left in a year an ardent Baptist and a firm believer in the doctrine of predestination. That's recorded. Before moving to Fort Wayne, Martin is replaced by Johnston Likens in November of 1819, a man of sterling character and will later become Isaac McCoy's son-in-law. Here a school is opened in Fort Wayne with 25 pupils, 10 English, 6 French, 8 Indians, and 1 black. McCoy started the First Baptist Church in Fort Wayne, by the way. In 1821, the Treaty of Chicago is signed, which will allow Indian tribes in southern Michigan to be provided with government-funded teachers, farmers, blacksmiths, and Isaac McCoy will soon be appointed by a non-ACLU-controlled government to implement the educational provisions of the treaty. There were enough discouragements that the average Baptist would have given in, but McCoy's determination is relentless. The Baptist Board of Missions neglects missionaries to the west in favor of Judson in Burma, which affects McCoy and the well-known John Mason Peck. Now, let me just stop to say this. I'm not dealing so much with the Baptist Board of Foreign Missions. But if you're interested in one of our books, Dr. George Eller wrote the book, Isaac McCoy, Apostle of the Western Trail. When you finish reading that book, you will be upset at the way that Christian men back east treated Isaac McCoy, not only in his treatment, but seems, in some many respects, they seem dishonest. But I don't think they were. I think that they were just blinded by the things of their day. Everything was looking at Adoniram Judson in Burma. And the Indians were looked upon as a nuisance. It let them die out. And so McCoy is neglected. He's treated pitiful. I have a Moravian friend who just read the book. And he lives in New Jersey. And he called me and he says, Gary, he said, that really upset me. He said, I believe there's going to be a special place in hell, a special pit for those guys that treated McCoy that way. And I said, no, brother, nothing. There are, as well, many anti-mission Baptists that add to McCoy's trials by attacking him. And you know, the anti-missions end eventually become the primitive Baptists, but they were anti-mission more in the mission societies than they were just against preaching the gospel to heathen. Well, these attacks, and the apathy and politics of his own board, caused him to be disillusioned with Baptists in general. And he says, I find the most friendship for our causes among the Presbyterians and among persons professing no religion at all. Before they leave the mission at Fort Wayne, a church is constituted with a Calvinistic confession of faith drawn up and signed by 11 members of the New Baptist Church. Signing were 8 missionaries, 2 Indian women, and 1 black man. 10 days after Isaac and Christiana signed the confession, with Isaac away, their 9-year-old Elizabeth dies. And within 4 months, the family will leave behind a second fresh grave. On a cold December day in 1822, the family sets out on a difficult journey to Pottawatomie Indian Country, where the city of Niles, Michigan now stands, to begin educational and missionary work among that tribe. Within 2 months of their arrival, McCoy records in his journal, quote, February 8th, breakfasted upon corn we had procured the preceding day. Blessed be God, we have not yet suffered for want of food, because corn is an excellent substitute for bread. But having now eaten our last corn, we cannot avoid feeling some easiness about the next meal. Yet a kind providence was watching over them, and by borrowing corn and flour, they were able to get by. It was at this time that Isaac himself becomes so sick, he thinks he is dying. But again, the Lord raises him up, and he establishes the Carey Mission, named after William Carey, the first Baptist missionary from England. Modern historians may condescendingly judge McCoy as running a medieval monastery, and that's a quote, that's what some have said, at the Fort Wayne and Kerry missions. But his regimented schedule was necessary to his family and Indians who boarded with him. He describes the routine. At 4:30 in the morning, the bell called the students to morning prayers. 4:30. They ate breakfast at 6:30 and then proceeded to their morning chores. School commenced at 8 and continued until noon. It started again at 2 and dismissed at 5 when there was another work period. Evening prayers began at 8, at which time there was also reading and exposition of the scriptures and singing. Every Wednesday, the teachers examined the youths on the chapter of the Bible which had been assigned the previous week for study. By the way, the government pays for some of this. All activity ceased at 9 in the evening. There were no chores on Saturday when most of the day was allowed for recreation. On Sundays, there was public worship at 11 and a lecture in the afternoon. A schedule this demanding would be considered oppressive by our soft modern society, but McCoy knew their mission was not only to educate but to mold the character of these young people. In comparison with modern times, sports have replaced the teaching of God. Hollywood supersedes Calvary. Television over diligence, child rights rather than human responsibility, and beer instead of sweat. McCoy did not apologize for demanding devotion from himself or those to whom he was entrusted. In June, after spending over 5 years working among the Indians and through careful consideration of these greatly oppressed people, he makes a decision that will become his driving force. The colonization of the Indians far from the white man's diseases, dishonesty, and especially from whiskey. In the year 1824, with the United States government having no fixed policy for dealing with the Indians and their treatment being dictated largely by expediency, McCoy receives permission from the Baptist Board of Missions to propose his plan of Indian colonization to the government, so that his trip to Washington in January is rewarded with an ally in John C. Calhoun, Secretary of War. Now, folks, this is a missionary that made the proposal to the government of the United States to colonize all Indians west of Missouri to get them away from the evils and the influence of what's happening. Others would give that credit to other people, but we believe it belongs to Isaac McCoy. Later that year, their infant daughter, Mariah Stoughton, dies of a fever. The third daughter to be lost since they have been in the service of Christ. In 1825, McCoy makes a necessary trip to what will become Chicago, and while there, preaches in English what he was told was the first sermon ever delivered at or near that place. Isaac McCoy preached the first sermon, our Baptist, in Chicago. So that's according to Cathcart's Baptist Encyclopedia. The next year, a second mission is started among the Ottawas. By the way, the Ottawas is the same tribe who had kidnapped Christiana's mother and siblings. But he named that mission the Thomas Mission, after Dr. Thomas, the co-worker of William Carey. Later, this location will become Grand Rapids, Michigan. McCoy is becoming well-known in many places as a knowledgeable friend of the Indians. And when, in 1828, Congress passes a bill to fund an exploration of the territory west of Missouri and Arkansas for the purpose of seeing what sites would be suitable for colonization of the eastern tribes, McCoy was appointed one of the leaders of the expedition. He was the principal leader for that first two tours. By the way, you know who he reported to in St. Louis was General Clark of Lewis and Clark fame. He was the principal leader for the first two tours from which left St. Louis and explored central and eastern Kansas. Upon completion of the first tour, he found he was immediately to return for the second. This meant that instead of being allowed to proceed directly to his home and embrace his loved ones, he would probably have to turn around and make another tour into the wilderness. Love for the Indians prompted him to readily and gladly forego plans for his own enjoyment. He wrote, "Oh, what should I do had I not a God to go to, and to whose care to commit my dear, lonely companion and our dear babes, the mission and all connected therewith? Here alone I find comfort. But since the friends of the Indians are so few, their miseries so great, and their destruction so menacing, who would not toil and suffer to support of this work of benevolence? Oh, that God would prepare me for all the duties of this service. This becomes one of the great exploring tours of early Kansas history. However, the Indians would take with him, they didn't agree with him, the impressions that they had of that land far beyond Missouri, because they said that they had heard that it was hot, unhealthy, full of serpents and man-devouring monsters. Fortunately, the Indians who traveled with him bring back favorable reports, and in January 1829, he himself goes to Washington to report on his exploration, and later that year, he will leave his beloved Michigan mission to move closer to the west to Fayette, Missouri, which is near St. Louis. In 1830, he and his sons Rice, who is now a doctor, by the way, and John Calvin McCoy, is the man who laid out the plat for Kansas City, Missouri. I mean, see, these people they're connected with years ago. There is a statue in downtown Westport, Kansas City, a statue of Jim Bridger standing with a rifle as a frontiersman, and there's John Calvin McCoy with a map over his lap laying out the plat for Kansas City, Missouri. But with his sons Rice, now a doctor, and John Calvin, assist him in a government-funded survey of land for the Delawares. The same year, the second eldest son, Josephus, who was also a medical doctor, sickened and died at home in Fayette, Missouri. The following year would be another trying one for the McCoy family. Isaac will arrive home from another trip to Washington on April 8th to have a newborn boy die in his arms the next day. In June, an exploration was made with his son. I don't mean to just pass over these deaths. I'm trying to record. Folks, I know in reading these people, they love their children every bit as much as we love ours. But they knew when they had children that the chance was that many of them would die. But they loved those children, and they keep losing them one by one. In June, an exploration trip is made with his son, Dr. Rice McCoy, and Mr. John Donaldson, nephew of President Andrew Jackson. This trip was plagued with heavy rains, swarms of horseflies, and on July 6th, Isaac is stung by a scorpion on the end of his finger, which he wrapped in wet tobacco and was much relieved within 24 hours. The next morning, a Negro boy, slave, is bitten on the great toe by a rattlesnake, which caused his whole body to swell, and the Cherokee master desired McCoy to help the boy. The bite was cut open, rubbed to bring a flow of blood, and after bleeding, wrapped it in moist tobacco and bathed it in salt and water. The rubbing would be continued downward away from the body. 2 hours passed, and the swelling left, and the boy suffered very little afterwards. A few weeks later, McCoy was stung a second time by a scorpion near the root of his big toenail. This time, the tobacco remedy failed, and he becomes very sick. He lay quiet for 7 hours, and on an attempt to rise, could not control the joints of his lower limbs. It took 2 or 3 days for him to recover from a scorpion sting. After this difficult exploration, he returns home on July 12th, exhausted, to be told his 3.5-year-old Charles had died 3 weeks earlier. The next year, his eldest son, Dr. Rice McCoy, dies and is a great loss. In 1823, Indian colonization was the integral part of McCoy's missionary work. His manner of labor had changed from evangelist to explorer, but never apart from the eternal welfare of the Indian. He will make 15 trips to Washington, most on horseback, many at the government's request. In 1840, while living in Westport, Missouri, he publishes The History of Baptist Indian Mission. One author says of this book, based on 20 years of personal experience among the Ottawas, Potawatomis, and Miamis, this is one of the most valuable contributions ever made to the subject of Indian life and characteristics. A plug. I've got 3 of them out there. We just received it 2 weeks ago. We facsimiled a copy of this book that's out of the library, the only seminary library named after an Indian in the United States. It's named after the Pratt Journey Cake Library. It's Central Baptist Theological Seminary. We facsimilate. What we've done is we have added a wonderful index to the book to make it useful. Also, McCoy has the distinction of having written one of the first books published in Kansas, a small 48-page item which appeared in 1835, a product of Jotham Meeker's missionary press and entitled The Annual Register of Indian Affairs Within the Indian Territory. There was four done. We've put all four in one book. We saw an 1835 original on the internet for sale for $10,000. Our book is expensive. It's the most expensive book we got. It's $55. I didn't even bring it because it's too expensive, but it's better than $10,000, I'll tell you. It also appears to have three succeeding editions, 1835, 36, 37, and 38. In 1841, when the Baptist Board of Missions faltered in its usefulness in regard to Indian missions and considered McCoy no longer in its employ, he organized the American Indian Mission Association, which met a definite need for that time. He's forced to that. Many wanted him to do this years and years before because of the mistreatment of the Baptist mission back in, they'd moved it to Boston, and the way that they would take government funds. Government would support McCoy, but McCoy insisted all funding go through the Baptist Mission Office. Much of that, or I'd say most of that that was for McCoy, would end up in Burma or other places, but not for McCoy. And because, see, their concept was different. It's not that they regarded themselves as being dishonest, but they were doing what they thought was right for the cause of Christ. And McCoy's differences with the board were not because he was obstinate or self-willed, for as he wrote, the contest has not been how the work should be done, but whether it should be done at all. I care little about the mode of operations so that there be an efficient operation. The American Indian Mission Association was organized in October 1842 and would be absorbed by the Southern Baptist Convention in 1855, 9 years after McCoy's death. Thus, much of what McCoy had envisioned and prayed for came to pass. In 1846, McCoy was now 63 and had served as the association's secretary for 4 years. One day, it was reported that he was sick in bed. They waited for news, but none came. As they sought his home, they found all was quiet. Mrs. McCoy came to the door and asked them to pray. He lingered but a short time, dying on June 21st, 1846. Just before his death, he called to him the faithful wife who had been his true companion and gave her his final message to the Triennial Convention. Tell the brethren never to let the Indian mission decline. And he died. So I ask this, how can any modern evaluate the heart and motive of people like Isaac and Christiana McCoy? An honest investigation cannot come away without being greatly impressed. Some people look at McCoy as self-serving and overbearing, but they would miss the heart and soul of full devotion. George Shultz tried to write an unbiased biography of McCoy in 1972, and it is an informative and worthwhile work that unfortunately misses the spiritual side of McCoy and thus becomes a sincere attempt to unlock this remarkable man, but without the key. It is true he had problems with the mission board he served and with some of his trusted colleagues. Any man who can match drive and vision will eventually run headlong into the varied opinions and goals of others. When he insisted on cooperation, his expectations were not self-serving, but based on his own experience. In journeyings often, in perils of water, in perils of robbers, in perils of his own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, that's what he experienced. Here is a man who knew what it was to suffer for Christ's sake, to be emptied of self, that the gospel might prevail. He had made the mental adjustment necessary to combine reality with humility and was useful and effective whether sitting on a dirt floor in an Indian mud hut or in the White House of the President of the United States. The question is still asked, was he right or wrong in his quest for Indian colonization? McCoy's fulfilled dream, through the heartless mismanagement of others, will eventually lead to the trail of death and the trail of tears, as many Indians will die in their migration west. But was the vision wrong or the ill-prepared government's implementation? McCoy loved the Indians and wanted them where they could be civilized, evangelized, and free from the evil influence of the white man. However, the government did not love the Indian and wanted them out of the white man's way and in the fastest way possible. And who could foresee the rapid westward expansion? If the Kansas-Oklahoma Territory could raise food for the colonized Indians, it could better supply farms for experienced white men, and treaties are thus continually broken. Now, if you don't hear anything else I have, I'd like for you to really listen to this, because for all of this, consider the inscription on the wall of the chapel at Bacone College in Muskogee, Oklahoma, by the chief of the Delawares, Charles Journeycake. Chief Journeycake was a Baptist pastor, by the way, and he said this before the Congress of the United States. This is his words, and it's inscribed down there in Muskogee. "We have been broken up and moved 6 times. We have been despoiled of our property. We thought when we moved across the Missouri River and paid for our homes in Kansas, we were safe. But in a few years, the white men wanted our country. We had schools for our children and churches where they listened to the same gospel the white man listens to. The white men came into our country from Missouri and drove our cattle and horses away, and if our people followed them, they were killed. We try to forget these things, but we would not forget that the white man brought us the blessed gospel of Christ, the Christian's hope. This more than pays for all we have suffered." McCoy was loved and trusted by the Indians, and at the same time was freely commended by white men or men of high office in Washington. Congressman George M. Prophet, in a letter to the President of the United States in 1842, said, as to the President, "Permit me to introduce to you Mr. Isaac McCoy, a gentleman long and advantageously known for the great interest he has manifested in the welfare of the American Indian located west of the Mississippi. Mr. McCoy has resided among these tribes about 30 years. He has done more than any other man to advance the civilization in the Indian country and to give an impulse to education and to inculcate industry, education, a sound morality in the tribes formerly resident of the various states. His writings on the subject have doubtless met your eyes. Mr. McCoy is anxious to have a conversation with you on this interesting subject, and this is to and it is to this purpose that I give this note." That's what Congressman Prophet introduced him with. The highly respected Dr. Spencer Cone of the First Baptist Church of New York City, by the way, who was founded by John Gaino, he founded it later on. Spencer Cone pastored that church. He was a lifelong friend, and he mourned his loss. Their friendship had been very deep and close. They had weathered many a storm together. In writing of McCoy after his death, Dr. Cone classed him with Eliot and Brainerd. He had proved himself a true and trusted friend to the American Indians. Now, Edward Cone, that's Spencer Cone's son, he adds this, "Isaac McCoy was one of the most lovable men we ever knew. Living the life of exposure, vicissitudes, and hardship, his mind and manners, instead of becoming rude and hard through rough usage, grew all the while the softer, holier, and more loving, never familiar, carrying out his quiet eye in an indescribable something that repelled familiarity, yet never repelled. Men were compelled to feel when in his company that they were near something good and noble. One accustomed to distinguish between men or to observe with any nicety the shades of human character would, before they knew his occupation, have fancied Mr. McCoy a Denizen in a court. There can be no finer illustration of how much the heart has to do with the bearing and manners that was shown in this man, in evidence that a Christian gentleman is a perfect gentleman," is what he says about McCoy. "What men of the world would think foolish honesty prevented Mr. McCoy from becoming a very rich man," he continues. "At almost every session of their lands by Indian tribes during his work among them, they would insist that he should have a part of these conveyed lands, and this would have met with a prompt approval of the government at this time, but he steadfastly refused or forbade it. In physique, Mr. McCoy was tall and slender, scrupulously neat, and well-dressed when at all possible. It is difficult to compare men in their respective sphere of service, but there is little doubt that God was raising up some remarkable men at this time in history to do the impossible. That our Lord ordained so many stalwart Baptists should humble us today. Adoniram Judson pioneered Burma for the gospel. He, like McCoy, sustained heavy personal losses, but by the special gift of determination, even in the midst of darkness and heartache, gave the people of Burma a Bible and a dictionary, and many were added to the kingdom of light. At the same time, Judson invaded Burma with the gospel of peace and an agenda of religious toleration. William Nibb was in Jamaica at war with slavery while bringing those slaves to the Prince of Peace. He also bore the badge of a selfless determination. McCoy was like Judson in that victory came through heartache and steadfastness, while he was much like Nibb in the role of reformer. So McCoy's got friends that he never met. These three giants, among many of that day, die within 5 years of each other. The McCoy children's unmarked graves are scattered over many states. His wife, Christiana, is buried in Union Cemetery in Kansas City, Missouri, beside their son, John Calvin McCoy. And Isaac's grave site is also lost somewhere in Louisville, Kentucky. He is buried in Western Cemetery in Louisville, and his remains may lie somewhere beneath a street that runs by the cemetery. So, if the stone of Isaac McCoy could be found and was readable, this is what it said when it was made. For nearly 30 years, his entire time and energies were devoted to the civil and religious improvement of the Aborigines of this country. He projected and founded the plan of their colonization, their only hope, and the imperishable monument of his wisdom and benevolence. Now, God used this man to accomplish much in a needed time, including starting the First Baptist Church in Oklahoma. Just as his father had started the First Baptist Church in Indiana, he starts the First Baptist Church in Oklahoma. Historian Emory Lyons says, McCoy gave his all to his missionary labors. There's probably no other Indian missionary of the same denomination that was as successful as Isaac McCoy. May God bless the memory of this great evangelical missionary. Thank you.